Welcome to the Berlin Security Beat, brought to you by the Center for International Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. I'm your host, David Bukowski. I'm excited to bring you the fourth episode of our second season focused on bridging the gap between theory and practice. Today's guest is Ankit Panda, a renowned nuclear analyst and the Stanton Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment's Nuclear Policy Program. Ankit is a key voice on the Asia-Pacific region and beyond, known for his work on nuclear strategy, arms control, and emerging technologies. He's also the author of Kim Jong-un and the Bomb, Survival and Deterrence in North Korea. In this episode, we'll talk about being an analyst in the field of international security. Ankit will share his thoughts on the challenges that new professionals face, the skills needed for analysts, and his approach to the writing process. Now, without further ado, Ankit Panda, welcome to the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So in this season, we're trying to outline the professional trajectories of high-level international security practitioners. I often ask our guests how their career started, how they move from theory to practice. So could you perhaps outline your career trajectory for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. Although I'm not sure I'd call myself a practitioner since I, you know, I've never actually been in government and put my policy work to practice on the other side of the fence, so to speak. But I take your point. So a little bit about me. So I currently work full time as a nuclear policy researcher at the Carnegie Endowment, a think tank in Washington, D.C. I was previously affiliated with the Federation of American Scientists. Prior to that, actually, I have a little bit of a not totally uncommon, but unusual background, I think, for nuclear policy analysts is that I worked as a journalist. And before that, I, was, of course, a student studying international security with a focus on Asia. Long story short, you know, I've been interested in nuclear weapons for personal reasons going back for probably to the late 90s. I mean, I actually lived in India during the 1998 nuclear tests, and I lived in New Delhi during the Kargil War in 1999. Of course, I was far too young to really contend with questions of nuclear escalation at the time, but intuitively, I remember it being the first time that I probably began thinking about the implications of what nuclear weapons would mean if they were to be used in the context of the war that was being fought at the time. And so I think for personal reasons, that was kind of where I would probably trace my original interest back in this issue to originate. But broadly speaking, I mean, the way in which I really got my start, I would say, is I wrote quite a bit about the issues that I cared about. Right. So I was in a position early in my 20s, where I was lucky enough to have a platform at The Diplomat, where I was covering not just nuclear issues, but broader security and military and defense topics in the Asia-Pacific region. That eventually led to a place where I could nurture my own interests in the nuclear policy topics that eventually would become my bread and butter day to day. So that was kind of the start. You know, I always had sort of a fraught relationship with theory in the sense that I don't dismiss theory, but I've always been very motivated by making sure that the work I do, the writing that I do, has some grounding and some utility for policymakers working in the real world. And that, I think, is probably one of the benefits of having that vantage point as a journalist. When I was doing that work, I was traveling around the world talking to folks from various governments, various countries with different perspectives on these issues. And it was a useful way to build kind of a baseline of what do policymakers care about? How do they think about the problems that theorists and academics and think tankers think about differently? And how do you sort of build the bridge between doing kind of policy work in a non-governmental setting that will have practical utility for policymakers and decision makers? And that still continues to be something I struggle with. I don't think I've fully figured that out. It's an ongoing project as the world changes, as priorities change. It's something that you have to, I think, continuously keep tending to.
It's really interesting to hear how you've put an emphasis on evidence-based work and work that is potentially applicable right from the start of your career. What do you think that professionals learn when they enter the field that theory or their education does not prepare them for?
Yeah, so that's a terrific question. I think the number one thing that I see with young analysts in the field is probably having a little bit of a difficulty wrapping their heads around the bureaucratic frictions that exist in the real world. And so the implications of real world policy bureaucracies, how they limit and bound what policymakers are realistically able to contemplate when it comes to sort of policy solutions, right? In the real world, people have bosses, people have pay grades, we have separation of powers in a lot of Western governments, like in the United States. You know, Congress has to appropriate funding, which the executive branch will then implement if that funding is received. You have, of course, politics. So all of this friction that exists in the real world often gets in the way of putting good ideas into practice, right? So it can be very easy to feel like you're a young person in the field that has everything figured out. You know, you have this great idea for, let's say, you have a great idea for an arms control arrangement, just to use that as an example, right? Because we talk a lot about arms control these days in our field. But the reasons why that might not be useful to a policymaker might have to do with competing bureaucratic priorities. You know, for instance, in the United States, we have a program of record for nuclear modernization across parts of the triad, and that is broadly not going to shift. So, you know, coming in with broad proposals to, let's say, scrap the entire U.S. ICBM force, which, you know, I think is an idea that's not necessarily too far out there. It's just when you sort of walk into those rooms and you start talking to lawmakers, folks at the Pentagon, of course, you know, they might oppose that idea based on their own kind of intellectual disagreements with it, and that's fine. But oftentimes, certain ideas run into tremendous bureaucratic headwinds, and I think that's important to appreciate. That's not to say that it's that we should all abandon thinking theoretically through what might be called the search for the truth, right? I mean, but it's simply, I think, especially for younger folks, important to keep in mind that the policymaker that they might be trying to reach with their ideas is often going to be dealing not just with what's intellectually a good thing to do, but also with what they need to do to keep their bosses happy, to remain within budget, and to basically manage a bunch of competing priorities. And I think figuring out what those priorities are, what those bureaucratic constraints are, is something that really comes with experience. It's very difficult to kind of pick up a book and, gain an understanding of what those things are. That's really an area where I think, meeting people, going to meetings, having an opportunity to engage officials and policymakers is a really good way to gain an understanding of those real world factors that I think are really important for anybody that's trying to do policy relevant work that will be hopefully useful in the real world.
Right. That's very fascinating. We had Brad Roberts on recently from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, who spoke about the complex bureaucratic process of passing the nuclear posture review, with tens of drafts and comments going back and forth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the one thing to add there is, there is a field of study called bureaucratic politics, right? So this is something that you are exposed to in the academic world. But I think understanding on a theoretical level that bureaucracies matter and bureaucracies tend to have an endemic effect on how governments approach problems is one thing versus kind of observing it in the real world. And particularly for anybody trying to put together proposals on things like nuclear policy defense, having an appreciation for, let's say, how the U.S. interagency process works and who the principals are that have a particular say on certain policy issues, I think is a really important insight.
That's really interesting. I wonder if you have any examples of particular situations that challenged you as a professional?
You know, earlier in my career, I think what I had to get comfortable with was being a bit of an outsider in certain rooms, first of all, right? Being potentially younger than a lot of people participating in certain meetings, being the person that had ideas that were out of the mainstream, right, with what the room might agree with, and then feeling comfortable voicing those opinions confidently. And I think that's something that's challenging to do, right? You might feel a little crazy as a young person if you disagree with kind of the policy orthodoxy in a certain area that you're working on. You know, am I wrong, or are all of these people that have decades of more experience working on these issues that thinking about this issue the wrong way? And sometimes, you know, it is the case that you know, one might be wrong in their own analysis, but other times, you know, your convictions are probably right. And, you know, you have your finger on the pulse, and it's important to feel comfortable kind of voicing yourself in those settings, right? I wouldn't say that I was necessarily ever, you know, I would not classify myself as somebody that's particularly shy, but I think having that confidence to still kind of voice your opinion, and really, I mean, even once, you know, you get some pushback on your ideas, making sure that you have the evidence, that you're backed up, you know, you've done the work. There's no substitution, of course, for doing the work and knowing your brief. But when you do know the issues that you're talking about, having an ability to kind of follow up on that, I think that's a really important skill. It's something that, you know, is also can backfire, right? Because sometimes you will be barking up the wrong tree and, you know, you'll just be wrong about a certain issue. And I think it's important to know when to cut your losses, right? There's ego, I think, can be very self-defeating, especially for certain types of, I think, younger analysts who might be unwilling to acknowledge that, you know, they might have an issue wrong, right? We all make mistakes, and I've certainly changed my views over the years on a range of questions. So I think having that insight of knowing when to push an argument because you genuinely believe you're right and you have the evidence to back yourself up versus kind of you know, taking the loss and reassessing your own views, that I think is a really important skill that the earlier one gets comfortable with kind of recognizing that is, I think the better. And it's really about kind of knowing yourself, knowing the limits of your own understanding, knowing what you know well, and knowing what you might need to kind of take a step back and reconsider.
Do you have any advice on how to build such confidence for people who are maybe a little bit more reticent or shy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to give generalizable advice because I think so much of this is personality specific and personality dependent, right? I think, for instance, extroverts and introverts have very different kinds of experiences in settings where, you know, they need to voice themselves and voice their opinions. So I don't want to sort of, you know, paint with one brush because, again, my experience might not be generalizable. But I do think the outcome based approach, I think, is really important, right? You want to understand that, ultimately, like, especially that part about barking up the wrong tree, like when you just might have something wrong, I think it's totally fine to kind of step back and reassess, and change your views. I mean, especially earlier in your career, right? Even so-called experts who are, you know, decades into their career don't actually know everything. And there's always a process of, I think, updating one's views and opinions with new data and information. That's just part of, I think, being a good analyst. And I think knowing that about yourself and knowing where your own intellectual limits are, I think, is really quite important.
Great. Thank you. I think that's really good advice. I want to explore more of the core skills that it takes to be an analyst. We've covered some already. Are there any other core skills that you think are necessary for analysts or advice that you think is really critical?
Yeah, I mean, I often, you know, in the nuclear policy field, oftentimes, you know, the limits between analysis and advocacy can kind of get blurred a bit, right? We all have, of course, our policy preferences that we'd like to see implemented in the world. And I'm not saying that, you know, analysts should strive to be entirely unbiased. But I think good analysts are able to, first of all, entertain hypotheses and arguments that they fundamentally disagree with and kind of think through them, entertain those ideas seriously, and implement that into the kind of work that they're doing. In fact, I think that's an important skill for analysts and advocates alike. Even if you advocate for something, you need to understand the opposing side's position well enough so that you can actually get to the heart of the issue and hopefully be persuasive in your own arguments, right? It's very tempting to kind of paint people that disagree with you as misinformed or otherwise arguing in bad faith. And don't get me wrong, there is a lot of that also. There are simply some people that will argue in bad faith. But oftentimes they're not arguing in bad faith. And you know, there are very tough, unresolved problems in nuclear policy that are, you know, decades later after the first atomic bomb test, we are still, wrangling with the very nature of how nuclear escalation works in reality. We, of course, have observed very few nuclear wars, but there are very strong views about the nature of escalation on all sides. So I think having that willingness to kind of engage openly is, I think, an important skill. The fundamental, though, and this is probably a really obvious point, and I'm not saying that I see this quite in a widespread way among younger analysts by any means, is simply, I mean, doing the reading, knowing your brief, right? There's no substitute for that. It is often quite obvious when, you know, you'll kind of meet folks who have very strong views on certain policy problems, but don't necessarily have the empirical or historical knowledge to serve as a foundation for what they're arguing for. So that, unfortunately, the only way to get that is to put in the time, right? Spend your time reading, acquiring as much knowledge as you can about your field, understand really every aspect of whatever problem you might be talking about. And it's always incomplete, right? You're never going to have that perfect amount of knowledge that on a given problem set. Everybody still learns new things, even about issues that they might have tremendous expertise on. But, you know, putting that time in, I think that's extremely valuable, especially early on in your career. That is actually the basis of credibility, right? If you are going to be that younger analyst that might disagree with consensus views in certain rooms where there are more experienced people, demonstrating that you have that competency, that you live in the same universe of facts as everyone else, I think that's simply non-negotiable.
We were at a conference together in January, and I remember someone discussing that in the think tank space, the job of analysts, especially now, is to search for questions or perspectives that are underappreciated or perhaps missed altogether. I was wondering what you thought about that statement.
I guess the way in which I would think about that is, again, it's probably something that comes as a result of experience and time spent kind of talking to other practitioners, you know, academics and analysts as well, kind of looking at where the winds are blowing broadly and kind of seeing if there are obvious questions that might not be asked as much as they should be, right, in the context of certain certain debates. I actually think it's rare and difficult to totally identify something that nobody else has thought of. I think that's extremely rare. So I don't want to kind of oversell, you know, the extent to which I might do that. But certainly, I think there are issues that are underappreciated in the public discourse, even in kind of discourse among analysts. And I think it's useful to interrogate those, right? There might be good reasons for that. There might be good reasons those questions might not be worth following up on. But oftentimes that is the way in which you'll identify a problem that has, I think, great value. And over time, actually, you know, others will join you in that. So if you are able to identify those issues, it is a really useful way to kind of position yourself as somebody that can serve as a hub for, you know, some of the discussion that's happening in that area. So, identifying those issues, I think, is still quite difficult. But again, talking to as many people as you can, and again, reading widely, having a sense of the broader debate around an issue area, that I think is going to be simply, you know, a very valuable way to go about that kind of work.
You're a prolific writer. You've written for some of the world's top outlets and published a book on North Korea and deterrence. You're now working on a new book. How do you approach your writing process, both in the shorter and longer format? And what advice would you have for younger professionals? I mean, I know it's very individual, but...
Yeah, no, thanks. It's interesting because I think as a writer, no two things I write ever really come out in the same way. I used to think that the best way to write was simply to, you know, put words on the page. I often didn't used to be a planner. Like I didn't really do outlines. I would just kind of start typing and the argument would take shape. And I've always been, you know, very grateful for editing. I think editors play a very important role in the writing process. And so as a writer, it's important to, of course, express yourself, have the ideas that you have the ideas that you want to put down on the page, but always be open to editing. Obviously, being edited is a privilege in many ways. Not everybody has access to editors, especially, you know, in the social media age where it's so easy to set up your own blog or Substack or whatever, and, you know, you can just get whatever thoughts you have out there into the world. I think if you are somebody that is working in a context where you have editors, you have second readers, you have reviewers, it's actually a really useful part of the iterative process of knowledge generation. With longer form projects, though, books especially, I mean, you simply can't do that, right? So when I was writing my book, I obviously had a plan, an outline, chapter summaries that, you know, I'd sort of envisioned the book I wanted to write before I actually started writing individual chapters. And And that's similar to the process that's playing out now, except the book project I'm working on now is a lot more open-ended. And so it's you know, really up to me to kind of make sure that the structure is manifesting as it should be. With short form writing, I actually think what's really important, especially for argumentative pieces like op-eds or policy analysis, where you're making a clear recommendation. I mean, you have to have conviction. You have to really believe that what you're writing, the idea that you're promoting, is truly right, that you have the evidence to back it up. I also used to edit a lot of writers, and I think I would notice that it's quite easy to tell good writing apart from, you know, writing that lacks conviction simply through, you know, how authors present their ideas. And I think the risk I also see here is that it's often tempting for newer writers to be a little safe with their arguments, right? So possibly rely on arguments that have already been made by others and simply kind of repackaging that in their own words. And I'd sort of discourage writers from doing that because, first of all, it doesn't really add a lot to the conversation, right? I mean, you might agree with someone else, but you know, you have to sort of bring a value add to the conversation. And when you have that, when you've identified something that you're able to add, I think that really does lead to better writing and frankly writing that you'll feel better about, right? I've done both of those, by the way. I mean, I've definitely written things that I would not consider to be particularly good, but when I look back on the things that I'm you know, happiest with or the things that I think continue to have value, it is really those issues where I felt like I had a you know, some original idea or a value add, and I think that's really important, right? The idea ultimately that you're trying to communicate is where I think good writing really originates.
Thank you. That's really great advice, having conviction and taking risks. Now, I ask this next question to all of our guests. If you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
That's a good one. Let's see. I'd probably say, I mean, you know, be open to opportunities. I think a lot of young folks plan their lives out a little bit too much, right? I think the way I observe most careers, including my own, take shape, and this isn't true for everybody, I think certainly, you know, there is an element of bias here, given that I am a policy analyst, which is a fairly unusual job, all things considered, right? This doesn't really go for kind of doctors, lawyers, and professionals, where planning is a good thing. But, you know, for creatives, for analysts, be open to opportunities. I mean, like I said, I worked as a journalist. I never thought I would, you know, I never studied journalism. That was never something I intended to do when I was in my late teens or early 20s. It just kind of happened. And then that eventually brought me to the point where, you know, I was able to open the right doors to get into what I do now. So especially, I think, for folks that might feel like, you know, your early career might not be going the way you want it, that's not always a bad thing. I think as long as you're open to opportunities and open to putting yourself in not uncomfortable, but sort of situations that you might not have expected or anticipated, that's actually the most interesting way in which you can, you know, identify new opportunities. So, you know, go to conferences and meetings, meet as many people as you can, especially, I think, post-pandemic. You know, this was something I remember talking to a lot of younger folks about during the pandemic when I was sort of doing, you know, mentorship phone calls and things like that, that inability to build relationships organically when we were all locked up at home and not traveling much. I think that obviously was a setback for many younger folks, and to the extent possible, you know, trying to make up for that lost time now, I think can be very valuable. So I guess to sum it up, you know, don't try to plan too much. Things might fall into place. Again, you know, that again, you know, accounting for survivorship bias is important here, but making sure that, you know, you're open to unexpected developments in your own life, I think is the way I would put it.
No, I think that's great advice, and that we've heard on this podcast before. I think a lot of younger people are very anxious and they're looking for structure.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think for, especially for younger folks, that, you know, that early 20s period can be, I mean, it is traditionally the most uncertain period, right? You go through your whole life, you've been in school with structure, you've been in college with structure, and then all of a sudden you're out in the world and you know, it's up to you to make your, you know, start your own career. And that can seem very intimidating. And if you don't have a plan, you don't have a curriculum, you don't have a syllabus, how do you sort of bring order to this great uncertainty in your life? And I think it's a source of anxiety for a lot of people. You know, this is advice I sort of universally give to younger folks. It's just, it's not the worst thing to kind of let yourself go with the flow, right? You might find yourself automatically gravitating towards the things that you're good at. You know, the market has a way actually of identifying the things that you might be good at and not so good at. So if, you know, you might have certain ambitions that don't pan out, that's totally fine, because ultimately, you know, whatever aptitude you do have, that can be a useful basis for really getting your start and you know, moving ahead.
Well, Ankit, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for coming on our podcast.
My pleasure, David. Thank you for having me. Hope to come back.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. For the latest updates and research from the Center for International Security, be sure to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Consider exploring the Hurdy School's Master of International Affairs, which features an excellent international security track. We look forward to you joining us for our next episode, where we'll explore how academics can collaborate with policymakers to solve security problems. Until next time, this is Dave Bukowski, signing off from Berlin.